happening now. We want to welcome our viewers from across the United States and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room. Good morning, good day, good evening. This is EdTech Situation Room, episode number 324 on April 17th, 2024. My name is Jason Neifer. I am the executive director of the Montana Digital Academy, which is Montana State Virtual School, located on the beautiful University of Montana campus, located in western Montana. Although tonight, I am joining you from San Diego, California, beautiful San Diego, California, where the weather is absolutely amazing, where I just got done with the tail end of the ASU plus GSV air show and then the ASU plus GSV conference, where a lot of interesting stuff regarding AI and tech was going on. But I'll toss it over to Wes to introduce himself. Good evening, Dr. Wes Fryer on the other coast tonight.
Yeah, I was going to say the sun is still up where you are, and it's down here. So I am Wes Fryer, and I am a middle school STEM and media literacy teacher here in Charlotte, North Carolina. But I'd have my K-State purple on. And I am delighted to be here to talk about the tech news with Dr. Neifer. So you are traveling a bit now and a lot more travel. So we're glad to be able to make the connection tonight.
Yep, absolutely. Well, what's in store for us? What are we doing here, Wes?
Well, we are going to talk about the tech news, and we are almost the AI show, but not quite. So every week or so, we gather on Wednesdays to discuss the articles we found during the week. And so we have some categories, and those, of course, include AI with a couple subcategories of ethics and legality, as well as AI music generation, which sounds cool. We've got some media literacy, like war, some technology and kids, some Google news, some security news, some robotics news, and of course our Geeks of the Week. And if you'd like to access those links, you can go to our website, which is edtechsr.com/links. And we actually have that updated. There's not very many weeks we can say that, but you can download the shows there as well as access all the links and subscribe to our Substack and all the good things. So, and we've got a live viewer out there. So if you happen to be joining us live, hello. And if you can, let us know who you are and where you're at. Where would you like to start tonight, Dr. Neifer?
Well, lots of interesting things going on in the world. Why don't we start with, actually, I'd like to hear more about Kremlin-backed actors spreading disinformation.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this has been, of course, long foretold that we're going to be having quite a bit of deepfakes and disinformation. We've had that, but now the AI tools are making this more and more, readily doable, easier to do. And so this is an article coming to us from Ars Technica today. And the message is that we do have quite a bit of Kremlin-backed, Russian-sponsored disinformation. We have a less contentious primary season right now for the presidential race, and so there is a little bit less, but the disinformation, as it has in the past, is seeking to stoke divisions. This is coming out of Microsoft and a group of analysts there. They report that over the past 45 days, groups have been seeding social media posts, fake news articles, trying to foment opposition to U.S. support of Ukraine, stoke divisions over hot button issues like electoral fraud, trying to promote questions about President Biden's mental health, corrupt judges in the United States. And so all this is being tracked and reported on by Microsoft. Interestingly, they say that the Internet Research Agency, which we've heard before as we've talked about these things in past elections, was one of the big sources of these campaigns, and that was a little bit more distanced directly from Russian government. Now they see a lot of this coming from a group that is called the Russian Presidential Administration, and it has close ties to Vladimir Putin, and the Russian actors here are not only targeting English-speaking constituencies, but also Spanish-speaking constituencies, trying to basically, trash Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky, promoting ideas that he's corrupt, incompetent, Ukraine is a failed state, et cetera, et cetera. And they've got some names for these different groups. But I thought it was interesting that I don't know how many people know what a sock puppet is, but these sock puppet accounts, which are basically, accounts that are being operated by a bad actor, who is trying to, pretend to be somebody else. Those are alive and well. So look out for the sock puppets out there, folks. And instead of just full-on deepfakes, they're saying that there's more AI-enhanced versus AI-generated. People are more likely to be, still be able to spot the video, so audio is more impactful. And a lot of this is not only being not just being shared publicly, but it's being shared privately because it's harder to debunk if something is just spreading on Telegram Telegram networks and other things like that. And so anyway, this is like not really a surprise, but yes, we're in a campaign season. Yes, there is disinformation, and I have kind of wondered as I've been continuing to wrestle with conspiracy theories, and we're wrapping up this unit in school. One of the questions is, well, what would you do in the public library? When you bring adults together, yes, you could talk about the moon landings, but how can you talk about, anything that would be contemporary? And I've wondered if talking about some of these well-researched reports about, foreign, sock puppet accounts and disinformation campaigns and things like that, if there's a possibility of that being not as politicized. But of course, much of that touches on these political hot button issues, and those are things that people can get pretty animated and excited about.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and the bottom line is that while the AI stuff here is interesting, it's coming at the heels of 25 years of a vast increase in the ability of people to push out information, right? And so they're clearly bad actors in play here. I don't want to suggest that there's not, but this is not a new phenomenon. And that's part of the reason why Wes, I know you beat the media literacy drum pretty hard, and it happens to be something that I think is we're vastly undercovering too. But the bottom line is that we've really still not shifted, I think, our broad cultural mindset away from the time where publishing availability of information makes it true, right? That, and in the same way that, and I will say that I'm as guilty is not the right word. I'm as excited about the prospects of people having a worldwide voice with two or three clicks as anyone else, including Dr. Fryer. But the bottom line is that comes at a cost with our society and culture. So, I'm not entirely sure we switched, our landscapes away from this yet. I will say that I do find it a little dangerous that I heard a discussion today about, do we need to continue to teach things like writing in a world where two clicks, gets you the writing that you're looking for? And I think one of the ways that I think that's a dangerous notion is because I think that the crafting and maybe there's an alternative to writing, like making a video or recording a podcast or creating something with it is the alternative there. But this notion that we don't have our students creating things on their own, coming up with their own ideas, and instead farming that out to AI, diminishes the fact that there is an extraordinary movement afoot, I think, to cloud our purview with information that is much more politically motivated. So I think that is something to be very thoughtful about.
Couple add-ons to that. We're doing the culmination of the SIFT and lateral reading, Moon Hoax Media Literacy Unit. And I've decided this year to do what I'm calling half ignites. And so the ignite presentation model is usually 20 slides, 15 seconds a slide, 5 minutes. We're doing half of that. So students have to do a 10 slide, 2.5 minute presentation. But I am allowing them to use AI. And many of them were really excited about that. But what they realized right away is, wait a second, I need to be putting this script together slide by slide, and 15 seconds of talk is about 30 words or so. And so it's led to some good conversations. And I think I'm continuing to really like, ideas about being a co-writer with AI, using it as a research assistant, being able to, brainstorm and use it as an editor and those kinds of things. So the other thought is I've just been listening again to this Moonrise podcast. I don't know if you ever listened to that one, but it was in New York Times, and it's all about the space program But it tells not only about the U.S. side, but also the Russian side. And it is so, so well done. Actually, no, is it Washington Post? Maybe it's the Washington Post. It's called Moonrise. But anyway, it also gives this real deep dive into what's happening in the 60s with all the upheaval, you know, in terms of civil rights, assassinations, the Vietnam War. And so, yeah, these issues of divisions and contentiousness have been with us for a long time. And I think in education, we just don't hear a lot about this. I think we should be using these tools to connect class to class, to connect student to student, to try to really broaden our understanding and our friendships and our connections to people in different places. Because I think, you know, the technology has never been better for doing that. And I remember in the early days of Web 2, you know, there were different teachers and professors that were real advocates for this and telecomputing projects. And how are you going to connect your students? And they're going to work together and collaborate. I just don't hear anything about that at all. It's sort of like we're back to, you know, the 1800s curriculum and let's, you know, prepare for the AP exams. And I think that part of this conversation needs to be, you know, collaborating and connecting and using these tools. What kinds of tools can transform some of our perceptions about the world and about each other? And how are we going to work things out, right? To be able to figure out governance and figure out compromise and collaboration and international cooperation and those things as well, too. So I think that, you know, Dr. Neifer and I are both, of course, lifelong educators and huge believers in the power of education. And I think that leveraging the educational technology, yes, in a world of AI, but in a way that ways that can humanize and can really transform potentially perceptions that we have of the world and relationships that we have. That's not what I hear there, what I read articles about, and I really see things happening on any kind of scale today. And so I think we need to keep our eyes open for that and try to advocate for those kinds of uses of technology amidst all the essay writing and those things that are taking place.
Right. Well, and I'd even go a step further to say that you just really connected a couple wires in my brain, Wes, that I wonder if, because I hear a lot less about that stuff right now too, right? And part of it is that I just still think schools are reeling post-pandemic, and I think we're in an era where the disruption that COVID brought education is really creating a mindset to go back to the basics, right? Like, are students missing core literacy pieces? And I don't certainly want to get into that discussion because it's a bit of a rabbit hole. But, you know, at the same time, you know, AI has some notion about hyper-personalization. I still find personalized learning to be a touch concerning. And one of the things that I don't like about the topic is that it's really, there's a lot of folks that just don't want to have that discussion. It's like, well, of course curriculum should be personalized and, you know, there's no such thing as impersonal curriculum and blah, 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 blah. But I wonder at the same time if having a group of students working together on a problem from, you know, different viewpoints, different skill sets, different areas in their learning progression, you know, has some value. And if we end up hyper personalizing everything, if that gets rid of some of those collaboration opportunities, right, that I think would be ultimately a bit concerning. And you know, and at the same time, you know, I think our students are becoming more skill diverse in our classrooms, not in a positive way, that, you know, a grade band, third grade, fifth grade, 11th grade, 12th grade, you know, it has much more diverse learners than it ever has because of post-COVID era. And, you know, we got to do something about that. The bottom line is that schools, I think, are continuing to try to tackle that problem. So, yeah, I mean, it's obviously, you know, huge systems and a massive complexity, but something that we should be keeping our eye on the ball on.
Absolutely. So are you mainly with distance learning K-12 people right now, or what is the demographic makeup of the conference that you're attending?
Well, ASU-GSV is, I don't know really how to describe it, other than the reason why I'm here is because several people have said that this is really the place to be if you are into tech infusion into education, and there's a lot of industry folks here, so it's not ed tech folks. There's some of that certainly for true here, but you know, Google had a huge presence here. Microsoft had a huge presence here. People like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, a huge presence here. GSV itself was a venture capital company. And so, and Arizona State University, which has been kind of selling itself as the distance learning market leader, was here as well. And I got to sit in some pretty interesting panel discussions. The one keeps coming to mind because of who was in the room. It was YouTube's director of education, TikTok's director of education, Canvas and Facebook's director of education, and you know, kind of talking about strategies as AI starts to dominate the conversation. And I guess the one thing I report from this is that I didn't hear, I mean, I heard a lot of interesting products that are being developed. That's great. I did hear a lot of discussions about ethics, a lot of discussions about scalability of these tools, little bit of discussion about, you know, the learning environment. But I also feel enormously convinced that, you know, those of us that are having these discussions, that are actively trying to figure out where to go next with them, no one's figured that out yet. And, you know, so I don't take that as bad news. What I take it as is a continued opportunity for regular educators to really make a difference here, because no one has come up yet with any magic formulas about where to go next with these tools. So let's continue to experiment and discuss and see what that can do for our students.
And I think a theme for that needs to be, you know, using these new tools to go new places and do new things, not just to go old places and do the traditional things. And I think that we really have as much a need as we've ever had for thought leadership and for, you know, some challenges for us to go beyond our traditional models of education and to, you know, be looking at, you know, collaboration, connections, you know, projects and just, you know, this the sorts of pedagogy and things we've heard people talk about a lot. And I know that, you know, there are plenty of people who are tired of pundits and they feel like we've had, you know, too much punditry in the educational technology realm. But I mean, we need, you know, passionate professional educators who are advocating for a transformative and, you know, powerful education for students. There are more choices today than ever. And I think that can definitely be a positive, but yeah, I think that, I would guess it's invigorating to be there, to be hearing these different conversations. And it's probably as important to look at the gaps and maybe what's not being said and talked about as what is being said and talked about. But how cool for you to be able to do that. So are you blogging the conference? I'm sure you're just doing all kinds of blogging.
Well, no, yeah. I mean, it's funny because I was never very good at that, even when I was a bit of a blogger. I'm not. I have taken a ton of notes. And I've also learned, too, that the value of conferences isn't the sessions are fine. It's the conversations in the hallway, yeah, or it's the relationships you make. And I mean, I was sitting next to a friend of a friend of a friend saying hi. And 6 minutes later, I was in a conversation with a startup CEO that we're actually going to schedule a meeting with in a couple of weeks to talk about piloting their tool. Because it was interesting. And actually we both figured out later that I had already sat through an earlier version of the tool's demo a couple of years ago. But I mean, I like the energy this is inserted into the conversation about ed tech, but I remain enormously concerned that we are making the same mistakes broadly we did with the internet 25 years ago that we're just only coming to terms with right now, right? I think the pandemic was evidence of our lack of preparation for digital technology integration meaningfully in classrooms. But I also see the same stuff happening already, ignoring teachers, not providing training for them, thinking about systems, you know, compelling some technology use, even when there's resistance, if it's in a meaningful, pedagogically based way. And that's what's happening with AI right now. And it's funny how quickly we lose those lessons.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're there. One more question related. What are you seeing with social media? Does Twitter seem to be less in use? Are you hearing encouragement to use other platforms? Is there talk about sharing on social media and hashtags, or what's going on with that?
the only social media I heard any mention of was LinkedIn this week. And I think part of that might be just because of the presence of Silicon Valley folks here, and those in industry. But to be honest, I don't think I turned on a social, other than LinkedIn, I don't think I turned on a social channel at all this week. Now, I'm not on Twitter really anymore, although I miss it because that's, I have friends there that won't move over to something else. I kind of feel like the ed tech folks, the conversation is really dispersed right now. And I think that's to the chagrin of you know, the siblinghood of all of us that would like to have these critical discussions and agree and disagree and make things better. But yeah, I've heard almost no reference to that. In fact, if anything, I bet you LinkedIn was mentioned 2/3 of the presentations I went to, and I traded LinkedIn profiles with probably a half dozen folks in the first 2 days of the conference.
Well, one thing I just saw as I shared our links to YouTube and Facebook for this on the socials on Mastodon, on Threads, as well as Blue Sky, Flipboard has now moved to the Fediverse. And for the first time, when I put in my W Fryer, I not only saw at mastodon.cloud, it was W Fryer at Flipboard. And I think the same thing is going to happen with Blue Sky, because I checked the box to say to Blue Sky, yes, although I'm westfryer.com on Blue Sky, I think. You know, I'd like my account to be federated. And so anyway, this is going to be weird because I'm posting three different places, but now they're all going to interoperate. So at some point it'll be like, okay, which one am I going to choose or whatever. But yeah, it's still, I think Fediverse and those kind of conversations are still very much kind of fringe early adopter conversations, which is not all bad, because there's, you know, there, but it's a more fractured environment where people are split, and sometimes it's harder to find people. So
yeah.
Anyway, we digress a little bit, but this is it's great. And I think, you know, the chance to be able to unpack some of this kind of stuff, I know for me, and I think for you too, is just a huge part of my learning, because, you know, we can read all the articles we want, but when you have to explain them and talk about them, and then hear somebody else share a perspective about it, and you unpack things, and then also you see stuff week after week in terms of, you know, patterns and trends and all that. So,
well, and let's just for a moment talk about that from like a learning perspective, right? Like, yes, I mean, you know, I don't think we're getting, you know, tens of thousands of people downloading our podcast, and even though I do occasionally get recognized as the co-host of the EdTech Situation Room, which I still find to be delightful when that happens, but you know, we do this in part because we need the processing, right? We hope you're getting something out of it. And if nobody was getting anything out of it, maybe we would do it a different way, or at least involve a glass of beer occasionally on the video, right? But the bottom line is that this is a processing exercise that is also a model for learning, right? Like, conversing about what you're learning is really super duper important. But go ahead.
No, you can finish. I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah, well, I think this is an interesting parlay into another topic. And if you don't mind, there's an article in Nature in late March, and I've actually heard a couple of podcasts with the gentleman that wrote the book that's reviewed here, and I downloaded the book on Audible. I don't know. I might have to download the book on Kindle too, so I'm not sure when I'd have time to listen to the book itself. But Nature reports on March 29th, a book review of a book that's getting a lot of play on different podcasts, and I've seen a couple interviews on shows too. The book is The Anxious Generation: How the Great Rewiring of Childhood is Causing an Epidemic of Mental Illness. This is Jonathan Haidt that is a part of. Have you heard of this book, Dr. Fryer?
Yes, and in fact, I've listened to some podcasts with Haidt. He might have been on Hard Fork, but I've heard him speak a couple times on a few different podcasts.
I think he was, actually, he's been kind of jumping up in my feed. This article itself is basically trashing on the science behind it. So this wasn't necessarily the message I wanted to give here, but I did think it's interesting. And I also want to point out that even though I think I agree with Jonathan Haidt and a lot of where he comes from, some of the science that he's citing is certainly open for debate. But I think it's really interesting to juxtapose all this conversation about how AI might impact classrooms, impact students, yada, 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 with this very real concept that we probably haven't come to terms with what social media has done for students yet, has or hasn't done for students. And I really do find social media to be kind of exhibit one of how, well, and we didn't see cell phones in general in classrooms as exhibit one for that. I think we resisted too long how they could be used as learning tools. And then when they end up getting embraced, they weren't embraced very thoughtfully. That I think those of us that were advocating for more cell phone use in the classroom were not just saying have cell phones out and available 24/7. They were, you know, we need to engage them positively and help students along with the continuum of learning that they can provide. But, you know, assert your instructional authority in the classroom to say that now is not the time for a phone, or you need to be finite in your approach. And that inflection point here in 2024 with AI starting to come at us with increasing speed and power, you know, we still have some of the questions of the day from 15 years ago that we really haven't come to any conclusions about. And I know that, you know, in both listening to a couple of the interviews, I've read about a third of the book now. I think that we as schools may want to start making some rules about this. There are no devices in classrooms until a certain age, or it's very limited, or we help parents make those decisions, you know, by giving them data to say that, you know, we're not going to use this as an educational tool except for these clear exceptions up until this day, and then we're going to free it up a little bit. We're going to essentially give kids kind of a driver's license approach where we're going to slowly onboard students so that it's not just, you know, here's an assignment, here's a device, you know, giddy up, but rather we're going to be very thoughtful in our approach. And what better time to have that conversation than when we're in the middle of a massive increase in the functionality of these tools?
And I think we've got to encourage teachers to be sharing with each other, myself, you know, strategies for classroom management. I just think it's so silly that we seem to assume teachers are just going to figure all this out, you know. And I have had some struggles this year, in part because I teach in three different classrooms. And one of them is in our esports gaming lab, by the way, which is the most tricked out PCs I've ever touched at all. And every kid has one with a, you know, probably 21 inch screen or something. And, you know, so there've been some different things, some low tech, not just high tech solutions as far as like, okay, this is what I need you to have on everybody's screen, because this is time to focus. And now let's engage with this. And it's challenging. And you can, you know, for folks who've been, I've been in the game for 28 years now. So that's a while. And, it's important for us to, I think, be experimenting and trying different strategies, but also to be sharing. And I'm struck by, you know, how little in my educational career I've had opportunities formally, we've done it at ed camps and other times, but, you know, formally to really talk about those kinds of strategies and skills. And sometimes those might happen at the beginning of a one-to-one campaign or something like that. But now that one-to-one is kind of an assumption in a lot of spaces, I think that, you know, just like the digital natives assumption is false, the idea that teachers are going to just magically know how to handle these things. And sometimes I see people who are just, you know, saying, put everything away, you know. And, you know, while there's time for that, if the predominant technology response that we have is put it away, then I don't think we are preparing students as we need to be preparing them to be adults with these devices in their hands, you know, who'll be going to meetings and, you know, engaging in professional learning and those kinds of things. So has there been a documentary that Height's been on yet? Have you seen like a video?
I think I might have seen him like an interview on YouTube somewhere, but that's a good question. I think I might try to get this book finished up the next couple of days and start searching for more information. I will say this Nature article, the book review, does call to task some of the data analysis, and I still think it's selective, a viewing of the data that suggests that social media has no impact on mental health, especially for kids. But, you know, it's a discussion we have to be very mindful of no matter what.
The Hard Fork, and I put the link into the chat here, has been good. And they also had responses from, I think it wasn't even Gen Z, it was even younger, you know, kids in college and things like that, you know, countervailing how important growing up online's been, being able to connect with different groups. Anyway, it was interesting to hear direct responses from folks for what Height was saying. This is an organization I'll put into the chat. It's called Wait Until 8th. I had not heard about this until I was a technology director in Oklahoma, and we had some parents that were advocating for this. And this was, 2015, 2016, throughout the late, part of last decade, I guess. And it's the idea that until eighth grade, kids really don't need a phone. And when we surveyed, we would have first graders, and sometimes this has to do with, parents being divorced and child custody there was just all kinds of wild things where one parent had given the kid the phone and the other parent didn't have any access to any of the, parental controls, and just wild, right? Wild to be handing children, a unfiltered, internet connected device with all kinds of capabilities. As the web continues to mature and, we live in this dynamic environment, the tools are getting even more powerful, and kids are just being handed them and say, here, go, no driver's license, in some cases, no restrictions. So I think those are healthy conversations to be able to be having. And I think they're good ones to have, within our family circles, as well as, things that we're doing professionally, and, learning about what different organizations are doing and what individual families and parents are doing. How are we addressing this? Because these devices are not going away. And as some of the AI folks will point out, I think this was a, who's the guy that works for Google who's been, Ray Kurzweil? Have you watched, did you watch the South by Southwest talk that he gave?
No, but I do have that queued up though.
Yeah, he's a super interesting person to look at, and I think he's one of other folks that I've heard saying, we're augmented now in terms of our cell phones, and because of my little mirroring thing, it's not showing up if I put it to the side of my head. But actually that is it. The transfer is slow, right? Because even if we're using voice or we're using our fingers, we don't have the direct neural connection. And that, along with nanotechnology and AI, he says, are three things that are just going to really be transformative. And if you think things are changing fast now, then just hold on to your hats. But yeah, we're always going to be slow to adapt in education. But it's incumbent upon those of us, especially that have been around for a little while, I think, to continue to be thoughtful about this and to try and advocate for some appropriate responses and to pilot things. And I know that you're doing all kinds of great things like that with the Digital Academy and online learning, and bringing some of those things to the wider world is an important part of the advocacy that we need to be doing. So,
yeah. Absolutely.
Okay. Where else would you like to talk about, sir?
Maybe let's cover. This will go pretty quick. A couple big Apple pieces of news in the last week or so. But this is both according to Mark Gurman at Bloomberg, and The Verge is reporting on this as well. But it looks like Apple is kind of starting to hard charge towards the M4 chip. Which is due out, I think, this year, if my memory serves me correctly. And one of the things that is going to be really important with that M4 chip is that it's going to have some kind of baked-in AI functionality. I will say that the M series of chips, for example, I'm on an M1 MacBook Air, so this is the entry-level MacBook Air that you can now buy for $700 at Walmart, and apparently it's going to start going on sale frequently at $650, even $599, which is a stupid bargain because this is a pretty great laptop, despite its older design. And, you can run local LLMs or local AI models utilizing little bit of hackery software, but like LM Studio is a good example of that. But apparently they're coming soon. And so what I would say is that if you are a power user and you have an M1 Mac right now, I would not go to the M3 at this point. I would wait around for the M4. And apparently there is some rumor that even though the M3 had a sizable increase in speed over the M2, and M2 had a sizable increase in speed over the M1, the M4 will be worth your time. And apparently a Mac Pro, too, might be a part of that strategy as well. One of the things I am noticing in the used computer markets, I almost the other day bid on an eBay buy that it was used Mac Studios with the M1 Pro that had 64 gigs of RAM, and it was only $1,400. And I had to slap my hand just because I really want that 64 gigs of RAM. But no, patience, Jason. There's a lot happening in the space. And so if you're an Apple person and you're looking to upgrade, I do think we're going to see a lot of interesting Apple stuff later this year, as it relates to AI, locally on devices.
And that Verge article points out that, the Mac, developer conference will be coming, as it always does, in early June, I think on June 10th. And not only is that always a great, you know, thing to watch because the videos will be great and just the presentation, but Apple, I would say, as a admitted and confessed, you know, fanboy, they do a great job with their developers because Apple recognizes that if you don't have the developer community, creating some great, you know, apps and platforms and software, you know, you're not going to be selling your hardware. And so I do, and this is Apple's MO, right? They are not the first to market in many cases. In some cases they are, the iPhone and these things, but in others, when they come to market, they come really, you know, they come in with a, in a transformative way. And so seeing what their AI plays are going to be is going to be exciting because I think they're going to, you know, they're certainly not sitting back and watching all of this happening with OpenAI and Microsoft and Amazon. I know what I was going to say a minute ago. You know, it's because of our sessions that I recognized, hey, everything we're saying is being transcribed. And I recognized that on Facebook too. And I think you're probably continuing to listen to Hard Fork. And I think we may have some articles about this too, is about copyright and all the ingestion of this stuff. But hey, guess what? We're on episode 324. And so 323 episodes of EdTech SR that are part of the YouTube, you know, whatever, billions of videos, are part of all this content that has been ingested and made into transcripts and all of that. So yeah, anyway.
It's likely that Dr. Fryer and I are now training large language models.
We're so part of the training data, as I've we always, all are. If we're on YouTube,
I've always wanted, you know, to leave my brain in a computer brain somewhere in the cloud. It looks like my dreams have come true. So
I've also, you know, I've got like over 5,000 posts on my blog going back to 2003. You know, and I remember early on there were these different kinds of tools that you could pull out, and it's going to be like, who wants to read all of these posts? But it's fascinating thinking about pouring yourself via dissertation, via articles, via blog posts, podcasts, videos, all that. And because this is going to be, I mean, it's possible now, but it's just going to become even more and more possible to say, here's all the content ever created by Wes Fryer or Jason Neifer or whatever, you know, and then you're going to be able to query and ask and anyway, do stuff with that kind of content. So, but anyway, the stuff on Hard Fork and whatever has been a little bit more, or maybe, yeah, I think it still was. No, that was, there was a Times report that I was listening to. It wasn't Hard Fork has talked about that too, but there was another one. I have to go into my podcast queue or my listen. But talk, you know, because the New York Times is having this lawsuit against OpenAI, but there's others as well, but they've kind of run out of stuff, and so now they're having to figure out, well, are we going to have I guess it was the Daily. It was AI's original sin. That was the one that I started today.
Well,
are they going to create synthetic data, and will the AI synthetic data be good enough to keep training the models? And that's like turning the keys over to the robot.
That's probably a good segue to AI for the night, right? Because yeah, and I heard a member of my staff, Caitlin Byers, shared the Daily's coverage of this. And I do find it a little weird for the New York Times to be reporting on this in light of the fact that it is a plaintiff in a lawsuit about this kind of stuff.
100%. They're spinning the opinions with this, for sure.
I didn't find the coverage to be as fair and balanced, maybe not to use those two terms in this particular case, but fair and balanced as maybe I would hoped. But I think it's a really important point, right, that there is a lot of issues behind this. And at the same time, like, if all these companies have to shut down and start over again because they decide that it's not legitimate, It will stop this process, but I just saw the look on your face, Dr.
They're not going to start over. They're going to settle, and they're, you know, somebody's going to get a lot of money. But
yeah.
I mean, Clearview AI is not going to get rid of their database. They scrape the web with millions of photographs, and you know, they're not giving that up. And I don't think these companies are giving up what they got either.
And this was covered in that New York Times article. Meta thought about buying Simon and Schuster.
Maybe paying $10 a book to every author. But they're like, let's just steal it.
Well, and just imagine that for a moment, right? It kind of reminds me of Jeff Bezos going around and buying the Washington Post and chains of grocery stores. But Mark Zuckerberg shook some couch change out enough to go off and buy a major historical book publisher to try to get more training data. And that was considered as a legitimate option here. Pretty extraordinary stuff. No matter what, it's just ever so slightly dystopian. Is what I would say is that it's maybe just a touch on the dystopian side.
Oh, yeah. So here's one of the links. This is to the Hard Fork episode from April 12th. AI's data wall, surprise privacy bill, what happened to the TikTok ban. That has actually not only a great conversation about AI and data, but also privacy. And it makes me want to follow up on this because we've talked about privacy a lot on the show, and we really need some privacy law in the United States to be able to move forward on a lot of these different issues. And so I don't know if you had listened to that episode or not, but that is a excellent conversation about that. And I'm eager to follow. At the time they recorded, it had not been presented in Congress yet, but was going to be. I think Congress went on recess after today for a week or something. But anyway, I think privacy is something we talk about a lot, and we've mentioned, you know, advocacy, and hopefully it'll be well constructed and thoughtful, which is saying a lot for a congressional bill, but we need some privacy protection and to have some privacy and data rights here in our country. And so anyway, that's a good discussion of that, as well as some of these AI data issues.
Yep, absolutely. Well, is there any other, I can't believe we're already 3/4. Is there any other articles on AI I want to get to this week?
Yeah, this first one that I put in here about Texas. So this is from the Texas Tribune on April 9th. And the headline is, Texas will use computers to grade written answers on this year's STAR test. And if you're not familiar with the STAR test, they used to be called the TAS tests or the TOS tests, and that, you know, thank you, Ross Perot and George Bush Jr. and all these Texans that, you know, brought us No Child Left Behind in this era of high stakes testing. Very, very interesting. And it reminds me, when I was director of distance learning in the College of Education at Texas Tech from 2001 to 2006. Can you tell I've worked on my resume lately? I was very interested in what the English department at Texas Tech had developed. And this was, again, early 2000s, but they had developed a system for assessing student essays, and it was automated. There were a couple grading. If it worked out, it would end up being kicked to a human. But it was just very, very early days of this. There was a program called My Access Writing that was part of the Apple package for the schools that were going with the Texas Immersion Pilot Project and getting laptops. And this was circa 2003, 2004. And one of the things that it had was some AI feedback for writing. So, you know, that was 20 years ago. But I think this is absolutely a sign of the times that Texas, one of our biggest states in terms of educational market and vendor and textbooks and all of this, and I don't know what the testing market in Texas is, but it's massive, is no longer employing human beings to, or at least at scale, it's initially using AI to be grading these writing samples. And so coming soon to a classroom near you, I predict, are going to be these kinds of tools. And going back to 2003 and My Access Writing, one of the fundamental ideas there was the faster and more specific feedback that a writer can get on their writing, the more they can write and the better they will write. And so I'm sure there are, and they're going to continue to be sort of the computer-aided instruction, just turn it over to the bot and let the person engage, you know, there. But I think these augmented situations where as the English teacher or whatever kind of teacher you are, not only are your students going to be augmenting their writing with the use of AI, but these AI tools are going to be used. And it'll be interesting to see how the control is happening in terms of where the kids are writing and whether they're going to have to go into a certain place and be on a lockdown machine or, you know, how all of that happens. But these are the issues that are being navigated. And I thought that was a pretty big headline. Have you seen any other state agencies or groups or in the distance learning world? I know this is something that you're talking about all the time for assessment. So,
well, not broad policy wise, but I do think that that's a conversation I keep hearing about. And what I would say is that I'm not entirely sure that, and ignoring my own opinion about this, that people in general will be comfortable with machines deciding that no matter how much training data we give it. I think in the end, using a large language model to complement human assessment or humans doing assessment, I think is going to be an important piece of this. But what I would also say too is that where it becomes interesting is that if we're going to use a machine to grade, then we should give students access to those same tools so they can check their work before they hand it in. Right. One of the things that always kind of drove me nuts about being a classroom teacher, and this is especially true in college, is when students wanted me to pre-grade things, right? Like, is this a B paper? Is this a C paper? And now to be clear, it's not about giving feedback. They wanted to know the grade they were getting to see if they needed to work harder. If we can break away from some of those grade structures, maybe that leads into, you know, better and more interesting ways of doing assessment that are more learning driven as opposed to just being measurement driven. But there are already a bunch of tools that promise to do this kind of stuff for you. It is interesting in a world where we have a need to have I would say controversial methods for scoring and grading students available, that we would try to pull in a large language model, because who wants to grade tests all day like that? Like,
it's
really the worst thing ever. So
would you mind talking a little about the AI music generation tools that you got?
Yeah. So these tools seem to have popped up in the highlight in the last 2 weeks. I think we've talked about Suno before, because that's the tool that's plugged into Microsoft Copilot that allows you to create songs. But in the last week, there's been a lot of discussion over Udio. We're kind of back in the Web 2.0 days of unpronounceable company names. But that is an interesting tool set that allows you to generate music by prompt. And when I say music, I'm not talking about, you know, create 2 minutes of piano background, you know, for background of your podcast. I'm talking about write a folk song about the delights of eating freeze-dried Jolly Ranchers in the style of 1960s, like churchy folk, right? So, you know, real Pete Best kind of, or not Pete Best. And now I'm getting my music history mixed up, but, you know, and you, it will do that for you. And so far, the only use I found for these, tools is to troll my colleagues at work. But, that's still, you know, obviously a useful thing, but you would be surprised how great these tools are just right now on Udio. There's no pay for model right now. You can generate up to 600 songs a month, which you can expand into, I think, 2 minute songs. And I've had it write jingles. I've had it write pretty ridiculous stuff, but it's really great. You know, at some point these will be pay for models, but it feels like every couple of months then a new kind of generation starts to capture the imagination of the nerds. First it was text, then it was images, and I feel like that it's now music. Video can't be that far away, although you know, the tool sets themselves, you know, when Sora appears from OpenAI, it's going to be a real revolution. But right now it's just watching their demos. There's no, you know, Sora tool that exists for us as consumers yet. But wow, what a time to be a nerd.
Oh my gosh. Well, and what a great time to have another play date. You know, this is when I'm thinking about just being with some other folks who have played a little bit with these tools and will play some more. Well, and I know some folks that I've mentioned this before, I think that really feel strongly that any use of these at all is unethical because all of these stole, you know, it occurs to me that one of the arguments that if it's not already being made, it's going to be made soon is that, you know, these companies are creating a sentient intelligence, you know, and we've talked about this before with copyright and all of this, that like Jason and I have the ability and the legal ability to go in and read these articles, you know, and watch these videos and we ingest those into our mind. Now we're making exact, you know, replicas of them that can then be, you know, extracted in verbatim. But anyway, it's absolutely fascinating. And I remain convinced that we need to play with the tools, tell stories about the tools, and, you know, share some of the things that we're learning. So thank you, sir. You've now probably, you know, this will be a wonderlink soon in my classes, I think, as we're talking about video, because I haven't played with any of these yet. So what have I been doing with my time? What am I doing with myself?
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't really know what I do with my time either. It just seems to disappear. But the other thing that's related to that I do think is important to mention, if for just a moment, that, you know, I understand where creators are concerned, right? I don't want to diminish that because it is really important, right? But at what point do we draw that line between, you know, think about all of the music that, going back to the Beatles for a second, the Beatles inspired, right? And the number of artists that say I was inspired by, or I, you know, sought to be, you know, like the Beatles. And, you know, you can take music history classes and you trace the weave of evolution through that. So does rock and roll, financial compensation to the bluesmen of the South in the pre-World War II time period, because that's where rock and roll came from, right? And so, was that stolen? Is there compensation required? Does you know, and there have been lawsuits about, I'm thinking about George Harrison's My Sweet Lord, that was actually, George Harrison was sued after he released that song by, I think it was the Shirelles, but over, you know, unintentional lifting of his intellectual property. Well, you know, where do we draw that line, right? And that, you know, most creation is expired by other creation. To quote Aaron Sorkin, who himself is a bit of a stealer himself as a writer, he wrote this line for the character Sam Seaborn in The West Wing, that good writers borrow from other writers, great writers steal outright. You know, at what point do we need to go back and give credit to the great, you know, creators of the past? You know, and at what point is that yours? And if I have no particular talent, you know, in music, now I do have a little bit of musical talent. It's not with my voice, it's with the instruments, but still, right? At what point is that mine? At what point is that yours? And maybe that's where these lawsuits end up taking us, is a really important philosophical discussion about creation.
And going back to the origins of copyright, right? Copyright was never conceived in the United States as something that would give a perpetual right to an individual or an organization to basically curtail innovation. It was to encourage innovation and to give a time-limited opportunity for that creator and inventor to, you know, financially profit. But yeah, remix, inspiration. I think that there are a number of people who are still listening to pundits and to mainstream media that is trying to say this AI stuff is generative AI. It's just fill in the blank. It's not truly creative. And I think that you need to play with it more if you don't think that these tools can be creative, because they certainly can. But all of the good stuff that I'm seeing comes from a lot of human interaction. So it's not like the tools by themselves are going off and doing all these things. You know, it's prompt engineering. It's the creative application of our imaginations to, you know, here, can you help me solve this problem? Can you help me create this? Can you make this better? Good stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, what else?
Well, I'm going to point out one other tool, and then I see we're very near to the top of the hour. I jumped into Ideogram earlier this week to generate some images, and it has a new major release. Not only does it have a slow and steady mode, I can't remember the name if that's the term I'm giving it, it's kind of a slow and steady mode that gets better outcomes, especially when you generate something that purports to be a photograph. It also has this really extraordinary new tool that allows you to upload an existing image where it will create a paragraph of text to describe the image to remake that image in the large language model. It seems like, in light of stealing intellectual property, a bit problematic in what we were just talking about. But as an example of this last night, I went and grabbed an image from a 1960s chemistry set, the box cover from a 1960s chemistry set, inserted that image into Ideogram. It created a paragraph of text to describe how to remake that same image. I deleted the reference to the individual image and had it recreate that with my own text and guidance in it. And it did an amazing job of creating like chemistry set images with different assumptions behind it. And it was really mind blowing. And unfortunately I discovered it 10 minutes before I had planned on going to sleep last night. So I lost an hour of my life to this without even knowing that the hour had left. So Ideogram continues to be a really great tool. And there is a free version that doesn't have these tools in it. It's $20 a month otherwise. I would say that unless you are really good at Midjourney and you wanted to license a tool, I would actually license Ideogram over any of the other available generation tools.
For images.
Yeah, for images, yep.
And I don't know how many people realize this, but when you use ChatGPT for Turbo, the latest version, to generate images, it will create a pretty significant description of how it made that image. So if you want to think about an activity for an AI playdate, you know, kind of cool now, and you see different articles about folks comparing. In fact, I saw a post today on Facebook. You know, we took this prompt and we use this with, you know, Copilot, and we use this with ChatGPT, and, you know, add Ideogram to that as well. So it's just amazing. We're continuing to do our Mars outpost design, and I'll have to give Ideogram a spin. But it also speaks to the importance of prompt engineering and good description, right? Descriptive writing. But how amazing to think about the augmentation here that, here, let me take this picture, get that description. I can use that as my rough draft, further enhance that, then, you know, let other tools create. And the power of visualization. I was listening to something the other day talking about, you know, medieval cathedrals and the importance of stained glass and visualization and communicating with the masses and the peasants and the illiterate. And even though we're a much more literate society today, images are so key and so important. And I think it's very compelling. It's fun. It's also mind-blowing. And it also makes the power and the creative power of these tools visible in a way that I don't know how quickly text can. I think that you can have an aha moment with image generation with these tools, maybe even faster than you can with text. So, wow.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Well, Dr. Fryer, is there anything else you want to cover before we jump into our show outro?
Let's see. There's a new Boston Dynamics Atlas robot. Maybe just this quick security one. This is an Ars Technica from April 8th. Critical takeover vulnerabilities in 92,000 D-Link devices. We've talked about the dangers posed by Internet of Things. These are not under service warranty coverage by D-Link. So, hey, hackers have figured out how to put malware and use these, you know, devices in their zombie botnets and I'm sure other things. And oh well. And these are issues that we're going to need to address probably through regulation, right? Because when you have an internet connected device that you've put out there, you know, being able to just walk away from it, it's kind of like you've just put your, you know, your oil well into the ground. And then after it's dry, you're like, oh well, sorry. You know, no, wait a second. I think you need to pull that thing out and clean it up. And the damage that can be done here is significant. So anyway, that's more of a sign of the times. If you got a D-Link thing, one of these D-Link devices, just, you know, unplug it, destroy it, and go buy a Google Nest or something.
Yeah. And by the way, I was just looking at that video about the new Boston Dynamics robot and Sweet Mother of Troy. That's terrifying.
It is. It's amazing. Yeah. I'm going to be showing that to my kids as well. Yeah, so, absolutely. All right. I think we probably ought to geek of the week it. I'm only doing one. Can you believe it? It's like the first time ever. This is called Storygraph, and their byline is, because life's too short for a book you're not in the mood for. So use some AI algorithms, and it will import, if you use Goodreads, your entire Goodreads history. I just did that tonight, actually. Answer different questions, and it's going to help you discover some new books. And I think that looks pretty cool. I like books. How about you?
Well, I'd like to share what is a bit of a time suck, but pretty great. I've been doing a lot of local large language models lately and trying to figure out, can I put one on my laptop that is going to be good enough for me to use to use regularly when I don't have access to the internet, which is not all that often. But there is a wonderful website that it doesn't just tell you how good which models are best. It actually has you judge. And the way it does that is that it presents you an opportunity to prompt the large language model itself. You see the output and then you vote on which output is best. And then over time, it creates a leaderboard. And right now, the leaderboard has in the top five, and of course, it's going to take a second to load. Please load faster. The leaderboard is currently ChatGPT 4 Turbo. That's the most recent release. Claude 3 Opus is slightly behind that. GPT 4 preview or a couple preview bots. Bard is 5, Claude 3 Sonnet is tied for 5, number 7 is Command R, which is a new open source model that was out a couple weeks ago, along with regular old ChatGPT 4. And so if you're keeping track of this and want to know what the best tools are from actual output judged by humans and not measurements that are sometimes hard to notice or understand, then I think that's kind of a fun place to go if you are keeping an eye on the nerdy part of these conversations.
And what an eye-opener in terms of the numbers of models that are out there, right? Because we tend to hear just about some of the big ones, and oh my gosh, there's a lot.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, Dr. Fryer, where can people find you on the interwebs?
I am still at westfryer.com, and I've got links to lots of places, including my Cook with Wes barbecue, which I'm sure is my best social media channel. So how about you?
I am at AIcentrics.com, but this thing here is the Ethics Situation Room. We're a once-a-week podcast on Wednesday nights, 6 p.m. Pacific time, which I'm saying because I happen to be sitting in Pacific time, and 9 p.m. Eastern time if you happen to be on the East Coast somewhere in the middle of the night, UTC. Hey, we'd love it if you join it live. You can see us live on YouTube or live on Facebook video. But if you can't, you can find the podcast wherever find your podcasts are aggregated or archived on YouTube or Facebook, or go to our website, edtechsr.com. Check out the links or download tiny MP3 files to listen on your device of choice. But hey, stay safe, stay savvy. We hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time on the EdTech Situation Room. Good night.
Good night, everybody.